I've been traveling for all of my life, basically. My parents were, or still are, very passionate travelers. So I was lucky to be taken around the world by them when I was a child, and it's something that I've continued doing. You know, I took the classic gap year after high school and traveled for a year. So I've always kind of been out there seeing the world, and I eventually managed to turn that into a profession. When I got to about 25 or so, I managed to start becoming a travel writer. So, you know, I've always been interested in travel. I've always been interested in the world. And for the last sort of 12 or 13 years, I've been writing a column for The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald, which is a sort of an opinion thing, which you don't actually see that much of in the travel space. A lot of it is sort of these bright, flowery features about how great everything is and you know, how wonderful the travel experience is. And there's certainly a place for that, I think, but I've been given the sort of luxury and the space to write about things that I really care about, things that I think travelers should be talking about, that everyone should be talking about. You know, sometimes that can be sort of fairly lighthearted and silly. Sometimes it can be more serious. But I really sort of enjoy the opportunity to explore some avenues of travel that a lot of writers don't get the chance to do, I suppose. People often email me or message me and say, you know, just keep politics out of the travel pages. We just come to travel for an escape, to relax kind of thing. That's what travel's all about. And to me, it just seems like that's not actually possible for so many people and really for all of us if we think about the way we travel and, you know, the places we go and the things that we choose to do there. It does have an inherently political nature to it, whether that's, you know, choosing which country you're going to go to or choosing what sort of tourism you're going to do, even in Australia, you know, where you decide to go and what you decide to do. There's sort of an element of politics to it. And fortunately, I think, you know, I was writing about people like myself, who is a white male, middle class, extremely privileged for those reasons. You know, you can sort of float through travel without having to think too much about some of the bad stuff that tends not to affect you, whereas, you know, a lot of other people don't have that luxury. And so I'm trying to draw attention to that while also drawing attention to the fact that everything we do really does have some sort of political consequence to it.
You're right. And I mean, travel, if we take it back to its really real core essence, is intended to be a learning reciprocal relationship between guest and host. And so no matter how much we desire our holiday as escape, and we all want that sometimes, if we're taking our expense at the cost of our host, then that's probably a fairly selfish way of getting our pleasure, is it not?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there's so much tourism now into developing countries, semi-developed countries, that we just sort of do without really thinking too much about it. You know, I've been thinking about some of the things that we count as attractions. You know, people do favela tours in Rio or slum tours in Mumbai, or, you know, we go to visit sites like the Killing Fields in Cambodia. You know, these places with really sort of torn histories and you know, really quite shocking conditions for the people that call that home. And for us to kind of float through as tourists and just have a look and take some photos and feel like we've had a learning experience, you know, maybe we have had a learning experience, and maybe that's a good thing. This is where there's some grey areas come into it. But you also need to consider, you know, should we actually be in those places? Is it, you know, what's it like for the people who live in those places or who have history in those places to have tourists coming in and treating this as an attraction they get to go home and tell all their friends about?
Yeah, that I've been part of dark tourism. And also looking at the responsibilities to our hosts. I've interviewed Bess Hepworth on LGBTI travel, and she said that for many people, including the air crews when we can fly, can be really unsettling and, in fact, even threatening space because of some of the countries they go through. LGBTI are not welcomed and possibly even in dangerous space.
Absolutely. And this is what I was writing about when I was talking about privilege and the privilege that I, as a heterosexual white male, don't have to think about those things. But you're absolutely right. You know, if I was to write a column about, you know, countries that have these draconian laws against homosexuality, I'm sure people would write to me and say, hey, you know, we don't want to read about this. We just want to read about the nice stuff. And And that's fine because you don't have to worry about that stuff when you travel. But for some people, that is absolutely a concern and something that you need to look into and something that you need to research and know about before you travel, because you could get yourself into a lot of trouble just by acting in a way that's completely natural and lawful in the country that you come from. When anyone chooses to go to a country that has those laws, you are sort of, you know, in effect choosing to support that country, and there's a tacit agreement that what they're doing is okay in some ways. Again, I feel like there are so many grey areas here because I'm not a fan of travel boycotts. I feel like we should be going around to the world and taking ourselves to places with regimes that we may not agree with, because I feel like the world is a better place when we all get out there and meet each other and see things with our own eyes. And so I don't suggest that we should, you know, stay away from a country like Iran or stay away from a country like China that may be doing things that you possibly disagree with. I think, you know, you have to separate a government and its people for starters, and it is better if we all go out there and see each other and sort of break down a few of these boundaries that can build up when you don't actually have that personal interaction. But at the same time, you know, as I was saying, you might be directly affected by some of the laws in that country, and so absolutely you have to know about that before you go. And for others who don't, you know, you need to educate yourself as well and know what's going on in the world and how this affects other people that you call friends or family or you know, are just strangers on the street.
Travel, you're right. It's educational, it's reciprocal. And once you've actually met people, it's harder to build stereotypes around them or continue to think the stereotypes around them once you've personalized a relationship. And certainly the Smart Traveller website has a brilliant set of going through the rules and the implications of any country you're visiting, so that you can be a little bit buyer beware, which you need to be, because as you said, just because you're an Australian citizen, that doesn't mean you're operating under Australian law when you're in somebody else's country. You're in their law. But it still leaves that grey area, as you said, of how far is it educational, how far is it tacit support for another country's regime.
Yeah, and also when we're talking about things like dark tourism, slum tourism, you know, at what point does it stop being educational and become voyeuristic? And as I said, these are these grey areas that I think is really worth people thinking about and deeply considering before they travel and before they make decisions to spend their money in certain places.
Well, is now the best time to be doing this, Ben? Because one of the things, as you'd be aware, with a lot of travel industry and government support, is that they're looking at the COVID enforced strictures as an opportunity to sort of hit pause, hit reflect, and look at a little bit of where tourism had gone in the past, and possibly an opportunity to peel back some of the excesses, because I think there had been. And to get back to that quintessential, if I pronounce the word correctly, relationship between host and guest, the learning opportunity, the development. Is this an opportunity, do you think, for consumers to be thinking, while they can't travel, to become a little bit more savvy about what they choose and why?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is an ideal time to reflect on a lot of those things. You know, there's a lot of people calling for changes in the tourism industry, saying things should be done different. You know, the over-tourism in certain places, particularly in Western Europe, needs to stop, as you say, some of those excesses. But I think, you know, in some ways, obviously, we do need to put pressure on the tourism industry to make those changes. But it's up to travellers to make those changes for themselves as well. We need to change the way that we're travelling to reflect, you know, the way we want the world to function. Certainly, there are a lot of rule changes that are going to come in. Places like Venice and Amsterdam and Barcelona and Lisbon, I know, are currently tinkering in this downtime. They're sort of tinkering with ideas and ways to sort of arrest that slide into really excessive over-tourism. But it's really up to travellers as well to decide, to know, okay, there's problems in Amsterdam. They're having issues there with overcrowding. So why don't I travel to somewhere different, somewhere slightly different? It doesn't have to be a different country. It could be, you know, Utrecht or Rotterdam in the Netherlands. It doesn't have to be Amsterdam. And you know, the ways that we travel as well, these huge groups going around in cruise ships, on buses, you know, that this model where people do all of their dining and drinking on board and then get into these cities and just become bodies on the ground, basically, and move around and not spend any money and just get in people's way. there needs to be a change to that. And so if you have a problem with that, then you need to make that change yourself and stop traveling in that way and look for ways that are more sustainable and more respectful of the places that you're going to visit. And once again, you know, this is a thing that people may think about as politics. Maybe you call this the serious stuff of travel that people don't particularly want to think about when they're booking their dream trip to Europe. But I think it's really important. And I think, as you say, now is such a great time to think about that, to consider the way you travel and the way that that can possibly change to reflect the world that you want to live in.
That's fabulous. And I think we'd all want to hold that dear and all work towards that. What do we do when we live in a world that demands an Instagram fantasy of our holiday and that ticks off all the tick tourism points from the Leaning Tower of Pisa to the Eiffel Tower to whatever? How do we work so that people see it's cool to go to a destination, as you said, 6 degrees away from the iconic, or if you are in the iconic, to spend your time happily, as Tony Wheeler says, 3 streets back? How is that possible?
I think it is. I think part of it, I'm a huge supporter of the slow travel movement, which is the idea of, you know, instead of going to 10 cities in Europe in 2 weeks or a month or whatever it is, go to one city. And you know, these destinations are very much keen on that as well. Places like Dubrovnik in Croatia, they get a huge amount of single-day passengers or single-day tourists that come in and just walk around their old town and leave again. Don't spend a lot of money, don't really help things. They're just, you know, as I was saying, bodies on the ground, just people there. So what they would much prefer is that people go for a long time. If you go and spend, you know, 2 weeks there, and I've really enjoyed this style of travel recently. I've been lucky to spend 4 weeks in Rome just before the coronavirus crisis hit. I spent 2 weeks in Barcelona. It's such a wonderful way to travel, to really, you know, to go to these cities, which are quite touristy and you know, do have their problems with over-tourism. But the idea is that you stay there for a long time, you get to know places. You know, you'd go and visit those big-ticket destinations, attractions, because somewhere like La Sagrada Familia in Barcelona is obviously a hugely popular tourism destination, but it's amazing. It's truly incredible. And I think it would be such a disappointment to go to Barcelona and not see that. So I think a great way is to go and, you know, do those big ticket items, but at the same time spend a lot more time in the city and be able to get around and see some more things and spread your tourism dollar around and spread your presence around as well. And that's what, you know, cities and destinations see that as quality tourism over quantity. And if there's more people doing that and fewer of us, you know, taking fewer flights, taking fewer train rides, taking fewer car rides, just moving less and you know, staying in one place, it's a really rich tourism experience for you personally, but it also helps out, cancel out a lot of those problems that we have associated with mass tourism at the moment.